Hello and welcome to the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast, the podcast about board games and the people who love board games. And on this episode, I am joined by both Quentin Smith.
Hello, Tom Brewster.
And Matthew Lees.
Hello, Thomas Brewster.
What we're talking about today is that Quint has been on holiday. He's been on a little games holiday, a little games excursion on his ones.
Have you ever seen the film The Hunger Games? That's what Quint's just did. He was in the woods murdering other children for 4 days. How was it, Quinns?
It's not true, but what it was true is I was playing games and I was hungry a lot of the time. I went to a children's like log cabin outside Cleveland, Ohio, full of game designers and game adjacent people. And there wasn't a lot of food there, but that's not what I'm going to be talking about. I'm going to be talking about the lot of games that was there. In this kind of ramble, I'm not actually going to be talking about any board games, but don't worry, because all the games I'm going to be talking about should be very funny to hear about. I'm going to be talking about three RPGs, role-playing games played on the tabletop with dice and your imagination. I'm going to be talking about Brindlewood Bay, a new game of elderly people solving murders. I'm going to be talking about Bluebeard's Bride, a game where all the players control the same very sad woman. I'm going to be talking about Cowboys with Big Hearts, a game about cowboys with congenital heart disease. And then I'm going to be talking about a couple of games that are played on your feet, up and about, running around the house in pitch darkness. You heard that right. I'm going to be talking about This House is Haunted, a game that tries to turn a regular house into a haunted house full of ghosts.
Haven't we all tried to do that at some point or another?
That's right, Matt. And finally, I'm going to be talking about the new upcoming design by Alan Gurdin, creator of Two Rooms and a Boom, Werewolf in the Dark, which might not make it to Kickstarter because it is quite literally too physically dangerous. But I played it and I came back fine, although, as you both know, one of the players in my group got a concussion. And yet the game was so fun that despite the concussion, he regretted nothing.
I like the concussion teaser that you're deploying at the end and start of most recent podcasts so people can finally hear about this devastating concussion that's going to happen at the end.
It's all fun and games until somebody loses a concussion.
No, actually, Matt, even though he got a concussion, it was still fun and games.
Yes.
So my mum was wrong.
Before we get into the games, though, Quinns, I just realized that we haven't actually talked about where you actually were and what the actual convention that you went to was and was called.
It was called Cabin Con, and I wasn't kidding. It is quite literally in like a children's summer camp in Ohio. And I did not know about Cleveland's reputation before I left. I do now, and it's a city that has had some pretty hard times to the point that, you know, like aside from the one other British person going to Cabin Con, I felt like a lot of people in Cleveland were confused as to why a British person had taken two connecting flights to get to the Ohio wilderness. And then even when I told them, they were still super confused. It was like, you're going to a summer camp to play board games with adults? And what can you do in response to that question?
And this is organized by Alan Gurdin, right? Or somewhat organized by Alan Gurdin.
Yes. So this was the Board Gamers of Greater Akron convention, a historic gaming convention that had been running for a long time. I believe it fell on sort of like financial hard times. And Alan Gurdin, local game designer and Cleveland enthusiast, didn't want it to die. So Tuesday Night Games, Alan Gurdin's publishing company that publishes Two Rooms and a Boom and the upcoming RPG Mothership, which Shut Up and Sit Down is a big fan of, thought, hey, rather than this convention dying, what if we own it? So it is now Cabin Con. And if you want to go and stay in a summer camp that is like sort of decaying with, there was a lake right outside the cabin called Crystal Lake, if I tell you the Pantone color is like somewhere between like, you know, a shade of kind of skin tone brown and with like pipe sticking out of it. The best thing I can say about Cabin Con is that there were no mosquitoes because a snap frost had killed them all off right before I got there. So I felt myself very privileged.
Wait, that's the best thing that you can say about Cabin Con?
Well, no, okay. The best thing I could say about it is the people were lovely. And I actually did influence a couple of people to come to Cabin Con because I mentioned it just before I was going. And then on the last day of Cabin Con, some Shut Up, Sit Down fans showed up. And they were very nice. And I felt slightly weird about encouraging to come to this sort of like aging cabin in the wood.
Have they traveled as far as you?
No, they hadn't. That would, oh my God, can you imagine if some people from like South Africa or Thailand had come to Cabin Con and been like, this seems kind of small. But no, I had an incredibly good time. Huge thanks to Alan for inviting me and for all of his friends for making me feel so very welcome. And to Ken, who taught me some literal wrestling moves while I was there. So that was
fun. Wow. Yeah. You've got to bust those out in a video sometime soon.
I could teach you next time I go and come to your house to write, Tom.
Let's do games. Tell us about your first game, which is called Brindlewood Bay, and it's designed by Jason Cordova, Steffi Devan, Calvin Johns, David Morrison, and Petra Volkhausen. God, that's so many names, and I didn't expect to say so many when I started.
It's like
that.
A festival lineup, and I want to go.
Well, this particular festival is pretty elderly. Let me tell you, Matthew. So Brindlewood Bay is an upcoming Kickstarter RPG, which I got the chance to play at CabinCon, and... it is a tabletop role-playing game where you solve a murder. There have been lots of role-playing games like that. But what makes Brindlewood Bay unique is that you play elderly people. You play people who are really old. My old person's special power, which I picked from a list, was that she appeared significantly younger than she was. So while she was 75, she looked 50. And I used that just all the time. I played a woman who talked like this at all times, basically inspired by Mac's mum from Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And Excellent. She hit on absolutely everything, and I had a blast. Two things I want to say about Brindlewood Bay before we move on, because I think they're the most... Well, let's call it three things, if you two will indulge me to three things. First off, you two might know from my RPG coverage on Shut Up and Sit Down, I'm a big fan of role-playing games that encourage you to play teenagers, because everyone's been a teenager. Teenagers have their emotions close to the surface. It's silly. It's sympathetic. I had a feeling that playing Brindlewood Bay, playing an old person might be really fun. And you two, oh my goodness. Playing an old person in Brindlewood Bay has legitimately made me marginally less afraid of becoming old. Because the thing about being old is, and Tom, you'll have to beep this, you just don't give a f***. Like, you really, you have no care for what people think of you or for what kind of scrapes you get into. And Brindlewood Bay is really playing with that sort of Miss Marple thing where people underestimate old people. Like, one of your skills, I believe, is called, it's not exactly rummage, but it's something like that, where you can stick your nose in anywhere and have a look. Rather than like, oh, how are we going to break into this building to you know, like, find a clue? In Brindlewood Bay, you go in through the front door, and if someone finds you, you pretend you have dementia.
Sorry, I learned when I worked in cafes that old people are legitimately the most rebellious and rule-breaking part of society, for all of the talk of these young people being hooligans. Like, the elderly, yeah, they just ignore rules. The amount of times we have people who just came through doors, and I would see them stand in front of a door, and it would say, no entry through this door at any
no
time.
Pensioners.
And they would stop, and they would read it, and then they'd just walk in. And it wasn't once, it wasn't twice, it was constantly. They'd just stop, read it, and go, well... I'm ignoring that in a way that I respected, but at the same time, the youth get a lot of flack for a reputation that basically they don't actually have.
Matt, you absolutely called it. Like, our session of this that we played was set. There was a murder on a TV set, and we would walk up to trailers where famous actors were staying and just walk in the front door. Like, we just, and then it's kind of fun for us winding up the GM as well, because the GM just had to play endless NPCs who were like trying to escort our old people out of buildings where we shouldn't have been, which is just such a wonderful dynamic. A couple of other things I should mention about Brindlewood Bay. Your special old person's special power is named after your dead husband.
Oh my God.
Which in a game that's otherwise so silly, adds just the slightest touch of like depth to your character. And it gives you a kind of unified thing because you're all widows. But the central mechanic in Brindlewood Bay that's got people excited is that rather than murders in role-playing games where you have to find the clues to solve a mystery that's been prescripted by the GM, in Brindlewood Bay, you find clues that are left out by the GM, but there is no fixed solution. So in the game we played, there was a murder on a TV set, but the murderer wasn't decided. And as you find more clues, it's up to the players to try and jigsaw these clues together to think, well, it would make sense if it was, you know, this producer. And then you roll a dice and add the number of clues you've got that fit to see if you are correct or not. So it's a lot of people are really excited about this system. To be completely honest, in my very first play with a GM who had, you know, not spent as much time reading the book as she would have liked, it felt like we were framing somebody. Because, you know,
maybe you are.
I mean, honestly, there's a campaign in Brindlewood Bay that gets very dark, and it could well be the case.
Right.
However, Yes, it did just feel like we had three possible people we could set the crime up on, and we picked the one who we liked the least. So that's a bit questionable. But
it definitely seems strange to have an RPG where you're building a murder rather than like you are kind of in the same way that I guess like in Blades in the Dark style, like flashbacks, you're almost like constructing this murderer in real time.
Well,
like I don't know.
You know, Tom, it's really funny you say flashbacks, because actually the last thing I'll say about Brindlewood Bay before we move on is that the campaign as written in the book, and this is going to sound either weird or like ill chosen, right? But in addition to being elderly Miss Marple types who solve a mystery, the Brindlewood Bay campaign pushes you more and more towards unveiling a H.P. Lovecraft style Cthulhu plot. Right. A little bit like, you know, Dredge, if you played that video game recently, or Hot Fuzz. What starts as kind of gentle becomes increasingly sinister. And one of the things that the system does is when you fail a check and want to pass it, you can tick off one of these checkboxes on your seat to do a flashback. You do an incredibly disturbing flashback and then play the scene again. And the flashbacks often feature you spending time with your dead husband, or for my character, who was incredibly horny all the time, she remembered, I narrated a scene where she was sleeping with her dead husband on a beach, but then the GM added that there were loads and loads and loads of people in the sea watching us, and then suddenly, snap, you're back at the beginning of the scene that you wanted to pass but just failed. So I would not be surprised if Brindlewood Bay did have some kind of much more sinister thing going on where maybe you're not solving murders, but who's to say? Who's to say?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully not too much though, because, you know, if you accidentally walk into the, you know, the heart of Cthulhu, then they're not going to kindly walk you back outside and say, oh, you're not supposed to be in here, dear. So,
Matt, I believe that is the exact dichotomy that Brindlewood Bay wants to explore. You're old people who potter into places they shouldn't be until they go somewhere they really shouldn't be. And stuff.
I mean, that's pretty great.
Yep. Really terrific. Speaking of spooky stuff, I'll talk for less time about a game I've wanted to play for a really long time, but I finally got to play at Cabin Con, which was Bluebeard's Bride, designed by Whitney Beltran, Sarah Doom, and Marissa Kelly. Let me ask you two a question. Would you two like to play an RPG where you play the same woman?
Yeah. That's... Are we like all in her brain?
Kind of. You play different aspects of the woman's brain. So Matt, you might be the mothering aspect. You can be the witch aspect, which like, you know, there's a lot of like feminist knowledge passed down through generations to kind of, so because you play a very young girl, you play a girl who's, you know, maybe 14, 15 years old. You're not sort of like fully formed as an adult yet. So you all kind of play aspects of the woman that you could become to retell the story of Bluebeard's Bride, which is a fairy tale where in 20 seconds, woman marries a big scary man with a blue beard. He's very wealthy and he says, I love you. You can explore this house. It's yours now. Just don't go into this one room. And the woman goes into the room and finds the bodies of all of Bluebeard's previous brides. And Bluebeard says, oh, why'd you look in the room? I told you not to. And there's two readings in that fairy tale, one of which is it's a warning about the danger of aggressive men and who are controlling. And the other read on it, the opposite of feminism read, is it's a story about the capriciousness and the curiosity of women. Bluebeard's Bride is designed by a bunch of feminists, and it's designed to explore, it's a horror game, which is designed to explore feelings of female disempowerment and of... some of the more interesting rules. So basically you potter around a haunted house until you eventually decide whether to go into Bluebeard's room or not. If you've seen Crimson Peak by Guillermo del Toro, you'll be most of the way there. Alternatively, imagine something like The Addams Family, but with the tone of Bloodborne, and you'll be some of the way there. But one of the interesting things about it as a horror game is, let's say, Tom, that you are, you know, you're playing this bride and you go into a room and it's a weird, creepy bathroom where a servant insists you have a bath, but the bath looks like there's, you know, tentacles and blood in it and you don't want to get in, and suddenly it becomes like a weird brawl with this attendant. You might be the sort of like innocent virginal aspect who's, you know, just asking for help, and that's something you're good at. But at any point, I use my wedding ring as the tchotchke for this, but you're holding the wedding ring, which shows you're in control of the bride. You can pass that ring to any other player and say, no, I think I want the fatale to handle this and try and solve it with weird sexual energy. Or no, I want the mother to handle this and try and take care of the god. As a horror game, that there's as many rules for trying to like solve problems with violence as there are for what's called caressing a horror, which is just reaching out and touching really gross things and petting them and trying to make them feel better. But your aspect of the bride can only take damage when you're in control, which ends up being a really fun and curious, structure for a horror game, because you want to be in control, but then your aspect of the bride can get hurt, and so you then want to pass the ring off. And there is player elimination, as there is in all good horror tabletop role-playing games, because if, you know, the innocent side of the bride, you know, is in control and takes enough damage, then eventually your psyche kind of shatters and the bride goes, we're never going to be innocent ever again.
No more Mr. Nice Bride.
Yeah, it's it is probably one of the most challenging things I've ever had to run for it, because I'm, you know, a dude, and running a deeply, deeply feminist horror game was a challenge that I found super interesting. Players' responses to it were mixed. Some players found it really spooky, moving, fascinating. Some players really didn't get on with it at all. I played with a couple of groups, but it was one of the most interesting and thought-provoking games, but really divisive. What's a food item that is, I don't know, like, I don't want to say caviar because that's got like a, you know, an implication of like high class, but just a food that's going to split people down the middle.
Pineapple on pizza.
It's like a pineapple on pizza if the pineapple on pizza was served to you in a house you couldn't escape because of the patriarchy.
Pineapple on pizza to me screams fun and children's parties. so there's a lot of crossover there.
I'll move on to just the third and final RPG before I get into some absolutely batshit designs. I want to tell you too about Cowboys with Big Hearts, designed by Jason Morningstar.
Can I just
this title made me incredibly happy.
Yeah, I mean, the title, great, but also I just want to focus briefly on the name Jason Morningstar, which is it's an amazing name. It's like somebody did kind of like, you know, get your medieval name by saying the name of your favorite Hollywood murder character and the last medieval weapon you used to kill a knight with. It's brilliant. Congratulations,
Jason. Your medieval name
Jason.
Is your first name and your favorite weapon on the end.
Yeah.
Wait, so what would I be? Quentin Zweihander?
That's Matthew Halberd. That's good.
Matthew Halberd, though. There we go.
Tom Flail.
Oh,
I'm on some medieval weapon TikToks, and I really enjoy like sort of middle-aged men holding a halberd and being like, "Now the halberd's basically cheating." Like some I mean, poleaxe fans on medieval weapon TikTok and medieval martial arts people really they have a lot of thoughts on halberds.
Halberd is like is a big skip in the War of the Roses any percent speed run.
Oh, God. Jason Morningstar's a very famous RPG designer, designed such classic games as Fiasco and Night Witches. Cowboys with Big Hearts is not as big or ambitious or good as either of those two games. It's quite a slim little book about you all play cowboys, and it's a one-shot RPG. You're going to be done with it in a few hours, and you're on the trail of the Death Brothers. The story's... So it's got very, very, very fixed character sheets because, like, a lot of role-playing games, if they want to steer the story in a particular direction, will, you know, like, really narrow options on character sheets. So, like, rather than, you know, having a box where you write your appearance, they'll have what's called a pick list where, you know, you can choose one of five appearances that fits the story. Mm. Cowboys with Big Hearts is so fixed that the only choice you have is... you know, the gender presentation of your character and what kind of heart disease you have. That's all you get. Because in this game, you're a posse of cowboys who are riding out to defeat people called the Death Brothers. You decide kind of who they are and what's wrong with them. The game gives you a very, you know, very limited number of options for the story and why you're on the trail of the Death Brothers. And it's going to start with you setting off to kill them, and it's going to end with you succeeding or failing to kill them. But I know why you two are here. It's for the heart disease. So let me tell you about that. You can have syphilis.
Oh my God.
That has gone to your heart. You can have, I can't remember the other two. One of which is basically a lung disease that means you can't get enough blood to your body. The rule of Cowboys with Big Hearts is it's just basically imagine an incredibly cool, intense Western, but where you only have the ability to do anything that an 80-year-old person would do. Mm-hmm. If you want to do anything else, like for example, ride a horse or shoot a gun, you have to consume one of the three kind of remedies on your character sheet, which might just be a bottle of whiskey or, you know, like my character had like a little bottle of arrowroot pills. And you get these wonderful descriptions of like, hang on, I'll see if I can get them right now.
I do fundamentally love the idea of it's like, it's an RPG where you're badass cowboys. Cool. Make your character. What do I do? Choose which heart condition you have. It's like, cool, what else? That's basically it. It's
like, okay, really? Look, I've got the character sheet in front of me now, which is more or less the entire game. So I'm not going to do an American accent because it would just require...
Oh, no, you should.
So this is one of the playable characters, Mr. Winthrop. No, I'm not going to do it. I can't, Tom. It's too embarrassing. I've spent 10 years building up a reputation on Shut Up and Sit Down, and I would just lose it immediately.
And I can't believe you're telling us all about these role-playing games. You really put yourself on the line, and yet you can't even do a bad accent. Unbelievable.
That's because bad accents break the story. But, like, you can't take... Look, this is why you and I don't role-play together, Tom. Right. Mr. Winthrop says, "In my day, I broke more hearts than I left intact up and down the trail. But that day's farewell over. I don't regret my enthusiastic conjugation, if we're being completely honest. I have tertiary syphilis that has entered my heart, and endocarditis being what it is, my aortic arch is collapsing like a Greek ruin. My crimped aorta causes me to be slow and generally enervated. On the plus side, I greatly enjoyed the getting of syphilis in the first place."
Can we stop reading out letters from fans in the middle of the podcast?
So let's imagine that one of the Death Brothers was escaping you and you want to chase them down on a horse. You can't do that, so you will mark off permanently one of the remedies on your sheet. Like, right, I've got written down here is White Lily Foxglove Digitalis. Derived from the foxglove plant, Digitalis increases heart contraction and regulates rhythm. Now, all skill checks in Cowboys with Big Hearts see you flipping a coin after you swallow a remedy. If you pass, it generally means instant relief. My ticker is both steady and strong, and you get better. If you fail, generally speaking, something happens along the line of you shit yourself. because the remedies are not actually good, and you never know if they're going to work. So it's a kind of fun structure for the game where, like, all these scenes play out to the point that you're going to do a skill check, you're going to do something. And then the either-or of it is either you do it, you're a cowboy, you're watching a regular Western, or, I mean, I'll read out the fail for Floxcop Digitalis. Tails means my exhausted heart is near to bursting. Vomiting and uncontrolled bowels join curiously yellowed, blurry vision. And these sort of like side effects are semi-permanent as well. So you just end up like playing just the grossest batch of cowboys. It's probably worth mentioning here, it is a comedy game. I had an all right time with it, but really this was just an excuse for me to talk about heart disease for a few minutes.
I have nothing to say about Cowboys with Big Hearts other than it seems like a hard thing to role play, even as a comedy game.
What, to be a cowboy with heart disease?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I think the thing about Westerns in general is that death is always just around the corner all the time anyway. Mm. Like, if you watch any Western, all the tension in the scene comes from the fact that anyone could shoot anyone at any point. So, weirdly, heart disease becomes kind of secondary. Like, if it was some kind of contemporary game about heart disease, yeah, awful. But in a Western where you've already set off to kill someone or be killed, the specter of, you know, of heart disease in the background, it just... I don't know, you, Tom, believe it or not, you end up having a lot of fun with it.
It just means you can't muster anything more than a very brief jog. And it means that, like, when you inevitably do break into the safe house of the villain, somebody just comes over and turns you around and carefully walks you out the door and says, "Oh, you must be lost."
I think, you know, all role-playing games have basically just been power fantasies for too long. This is the cul-de-sac that D&D has led us down. And I think modern role-playing design is realizing that nothing's more fun than playing someone who just gets escorted back out of a dungeon after being told they shouldn't be in there, actually. Okay, moving on to some games that aren't role-playing games that I think you two would have jumped at the chance to play these two had you been able to. So first, I'm going to talk about This House is Haunted, designed by Gabriel Gomez and available on thegamecrafter.com. So what This House is Haunted and Werewolf in the Dark, the two games I'm going to talk about next, have in common is they are played in a house that is almost entirely pitch dark. And this is literally one of the reasons I went to CabinCon, because we had an entire like children's cabin facility to play in. Huge industrial kitchens, massive storage basements, dusty offices that look like they're from the set of Stranger Things. Hallway after hallway after hallway, and we turned out absolutely all the lights so you could barely see your hand in front of your face, and played a couple of things that aren't quite board games. But you two, listen, I'm really excited about like the space of board game designers thinking about what they can do when they kind of leave a table behind and just have entire rooms or a house to potter around in. So This House is Haunted is a small independent game with the laudable goal of trying to simulate a haunted house. So the way it works is that you all meet in one room in the middle of the house with some very low lighting, and the facilitator of the game, or you know, using the game's deck of cards, sends you out to different rooms in the house which contain decks of cards. Now, what you're trying to do is you then walk off in the night, you go to one of the distant rooms of the house, you draw a card, and then return. And ideally, that, you know, that card is like a sort of point which puts you towards, in the fiction of the game, like exorcising the house. However, Matt, you might go into a room at the top of the house, and then when you go in, you draw that card, and it says haunt, which means rather than going back to the kind of like the lobby where the players all meet after each round, you are in fact trapped in that room of the house.
Cool.
And the haunt will hear. Oh boy, it's even worse than it sounds.
But this, you're is trapped me in that room every party
until you're stuck in that room until you scare someone in the way written on the card. So that might be something like, you know, just sort of scream at them or ask them. I mean, another one was ask them for a hug. And if they nice. Do hug you, they're trapped in the room with you.
Oh, nice. So, this again sounds so much like just me at a party.
It's okay. Unlike a regular house party, here's the difference, Matt. It's that you will, like, so let's say we played in a big group of like 15 people. 15 people each had different rooms to go off to, so we all scattered. And then of those 15 people, like 13 of us came back. And then you're sent off to another room again. And from the second round onwards, you don't know if the room you've been sent off to has someone in it just waiting to scare
you. Yeah, no, this is twisted. I love it.
And then the closest the game got to being like, oh my God, this might actually be amazing, was on round 3 or 4, I came back and 3 people out of 12 came back.
Oh my God.
And then it's just like, you know, the house contains 9 people, bored out of their mind, sat in total darkness. And the only thing that will free them is if they manage to scare you in a super peculiar way. Now, I really want to move on and talk about the next game, Werewolf in the Dark, because it was transcendently brilliant. So I'll just give you one anecdote about This House is Haunted, which is that I went into a room and a man ran up to me. And I tell you, playing games in pitch darkness is wild, because if I can just nerd out for a second, like, your night vision is fascinating, right? Because mm-hmm. you think of your night vision as just like, I can't see less far. But in a game where you're really trying to discern detail in darkness to, you know, in order to win the game, you realize that, like, night vision is vague as crap. Like, I went into this room, rounded a corner, and I swear I saw something moving, like, only 12 or 13 feet from me. And I was sat there just looking at it, being like, is something moving? And then as it got closer, I realized it was a human. But there was just this tiny window where just a really weird, small, crouching shape was moving towards me. And my brain couldn't figure out what I was looking at, and I got genuinely spooked. And then the man stood up and screamed at me, dance with me, dance with me, dance with me, while dancing. And in a panic, I danced, and he went, "Fuck," because that meant that I was stuck in the room with him now. So then it becomes just two dudes stuck in a room trying to figure... So the card was, we had to... The next time someone came in, we had to ask them to dance with us, and they had to refuse. So then I'm like brainstorming with him, like, okay. So we have to dance at them while asking them to dance in a way that is so unpleasant they won't do it.
It's kind of like a really messed up version of Don't Get Got.
Yeah, it's kind of, but you don't, it's... Where Don't Get Got, you're trying to always not do the thing. In This House is Haunted, you walk into a room, and part of the dread comes from not knowing what
to do.
Yeah, what the ghost in the room want you to do. And often it's quite binary. You know, if someone asks you to give them a hug, it's like, should I hug them or not? Which does feel really apt for a horror game. Ultimately, though, This House is Haunted did see me spending 45 minutes trapped in a room by myself and talking to a man about his wife because we were just so bored. Alan Girding, who was running the game, asked for feedback, and I said the closest I got to being truly afraid, the highest my heart rate got, was after being in a room for 45 minutes might be an exaggeration. I do think it was closer to 30 minutes, though. Once we heard a hand on the door handle coming into the room, my heart exploded. Because if you've been waiting for 30 minutes in the dark to do something. It's like you're about to go on stage, you know? Suddenly you have to get this right. So that was absolutely electrifying.
Well, why were you waiting for so long, by the way?
Oh, God, because...
they went for lunch or something?
There's lots of weird considerations. Like, first, like, the game falls apart, for example, if people are running and giggling, because then if you really want it to become scary. So everyone's walking very slowly to and from these rooms, and someone might just not be dispatched to your particular room.
Right.
Which might have been a problem because we were playing in basically an enormous dark warehouse, which was great. but yeah, it's a fascinating experiment, and I would love to see it sort of like refined and see other designers work on that. But listen, you two, I have to talk about Werewolf in the Dark. So I've talked about a lot of weird games on this podcast, but right now I want to talk to you about maybe one of the most fun gaming experiences I've had in the last 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so Werewolf in the Dark is a design that's being worked on right now by Alan Girding and might well be making its way to Kickstarter at some point, or it might not, because it's just an incredibly physically dangerous game to play. So you're aware, you two, of the popular video game Among Us, right?
Amogus, yeah. I know Amogus.
Amogus is, of course, kind of loosely based on Werewolf because, you know, there's a murder and then there's a voting round where players decide who to execute. So Werewolf in the Dark basically says, okay, what if we played Among Us in real life, in a dark house, but with all the powers from Werewolf, like actual full geek Werewolf, where everyone has a special ability. So the way Werewolf in the Dark works is Alan was teaching it in his dad's house in the suburbs, and the atmosphere was electric, and all the players who played before were really nervous. And the way it works is that one person in the group is a werewolf. We played it with about 14 people. And the werewolf is creeping around the house in pitch darkness, and if you are touched twice on the shoulder, you die. Mm-hmm. If you die, you curl up in the fetal position, but the round doesn't end. The round only ends, like in Among Us, when someone stumbles across a body and yells, "Body found." Mm-hmm. Or when the time limit runs out. And then you return to the only lit room in the house, and you go, "I saw someone touch the body and run away." And then you go, "Who was it?" And you go, "I don't know. They were maybe this tall." So it brings a lot of weird physical elements into Werewolf. But, you know, Alan was teaching us these rules, and I was, you know, sitting around a table, and the atmosphere was just really nervous. And then slowly over the course of the rules explanation, I was trying to figure out why everyone was so excited and so nervous, like we were about to do something really special. And then, like, just over the course of the rules being taught, my brain slowly started to click that it's like, oh my God, it's going to be pitch dark. And the moment he was like, okay, go, and turned the light off, I cannot remember the last time I played a game where the moment it began, I became more excited than I have ever been like in years. Like, because, oh God, just even leaving the lobby where 14 players are filing out of the room, and you know that if any of one of them could be the werewolf, and if any of them touch on your shoulders, you're essentially eliminated and become a ghost, which is its own rule I'll get to later. It's wild. You get into so much stuff of not wanting other players to come near you, but equally you do want players to be near you because you don't want to be alone, because that's terrifying. Ross, who's the lovely British man who I spent time with at Cabin Con, his first round of Werewolf in the Dark was to creep down into the basement, which he hadn't been into before. He was reaching around looking for something to hide under. He couldn't see his hand in front of his face. He touched something which he didn't know was a pinball table, but he thought was just a regular table. He climbed underneath it and spent a full 12 minutes by himself just breathing heavily under a pinball table. And he described it as like the greatest gaming experience he'd had in years. It's just wildly good. You get into weird moments where you start trusting someone you spend a lot of time with, but then the more you trust someone, the more naturally you end up standing near each other. And then, like, I don't know, the experience of playing Werewolf in the Dark is like going into a room with someone, and then that someone is already in a conversation with someone else in the dark, and you hear it whispered, "Get the fuck away from me." just wild aggression. And then this is before you add in all the different character roles. Like, my first game, I played the gargoyle, which is, which as soon as I got it, I was like, this is the one role I didn't want. So the gargoyle is a villager. They're on the good guys team. But the rule is that whenever you change hiding place, you have to let out a blood-curdling scream.
Oh my God.
Which A, fills the game with horrific screams if you move as the gargoyle, which scares the piss out of everybody because everyone's on edge anyway.
Yeah.
But B means as the gargoyle, like I sat in the corner of a toilet and then someone would come in and I'd go, get away, get away, get away. Because I didn't want to scream because that would give away exactly where I was. So I was just desperate for them not to come near me. But then like, if anyone, have either of you two seen the movie Skinamarink?
No,
but I know of it.
Okay, yeah, popular horror movie which is like glacially slow, just lots of incredibly long shots of hallways where absolutely nothing happens. Werewolf in the Dark is basically Skinamarink the game, because once you're hiding, it's not, you don't even move. That's what's wild about it. Like, you will move in the first couple of minutes looking for a hiding space. Once you find a hiding space, you will just squat under a sink for upwards of 5 minutes listening to like thumps happening downstairs and trying to figure out if those thumps are people running away and being assassinated one by one. And if you should really go and look for a body or just wait. It's just safer to wait because you don't want to be eliminated.
This sounds like, I can understand the excitement of this because this sounds an awful lot like a game we used to play in the area where I grew up, which we call Fugitive, and it got added to it, all these rules as it went on. It got more and more complicated.
Oh, yeah. I remember you telling me about this.
But I'm sure we talked about it on the podcast. But effectively, it's a similar makeup of it. It's really dark. You can't quite trust your senses. And you find a good hiding place and you stay in it. And then actually, the game would go on forever if you did that because you just, you know, you're effectively hiding under a pinball table, right? And it's like, no one's ever going to find you. So it does become this thing of you gradually, you know, you end up moving around or doing something because you're either bored or lonely or you just want a bit of excitement, and it kind of adds this weird frisson where, like, you know you should stay somewhere, but after a while, like, you know, you're playing the haunted house game, you don't care if you're in trouble. I want to go somewhere else now. I'm bored of being here. And that's when it all goes to hell.
It's just, you really do feel, unlike in a game of regular Werewolf or even Among Us, which gives you tasks, you really do feel so much freedom to, this is going to sound stupid because you're just walking around a house in the dark, but the freedom you feel to just walk around and explore if you want to, you know, because you can go and find bodies, which is like a really active role, or you can just hide, which is equally great. I'll mention here that the clever thing that Alan's done that very, very, very quickly becomes a complete farce. And what differentiates it from Werewolf and Among Us is that, so let's imagine that you two die. If you're assassinated by a werewolf or you've been killed by some character power. For example, of course, there's stuff like, you know, the Slayer, who's a villager who can kill other players. But if they kill a villager by accident, they die. So as a werewolf, you know there is one villager out there who's ready to kill you. So there's lots of different ways you can die, but if you do die, you come back the next round as a ghost, and the way Alan ran this is that the ghosts each hold a tiny electric candle, can only move at the speed of a shuffle, and have no masters anymore. So suddenly, you've got a game which is theoretically, you know, played in pitch darkness, except by the third night, there's like six dudes walking around with tea lights, and at first I was like, that's fun. But no, it's not, because if you're hiding, you don't want three ghosts with tea lights illuminating exactly where you are. I have, and also every ghost gets its own little weird, stupid ghost power. And the most I think I laughed during all of Cabin Con was being given a ghost, which is, it's not called this, but it's called something like the Papara ghost. And rather than a tea light, every 10 seconds, you're allowed to take a flash selfie with your phone. Which I have a gallery on my phone now of 10 just side-splittingly funny photos of like me squatting down next to players who are hiding to take selfies with them.
That's superb.
That's really good.
It's phenomenal. There's one of the roles in the game that we did get to see in action is that it's nerd werewolf. It's, you know, two rooms and a boom, so it's conditionality on conditionality. But one of the roles is the blob, which is a villager where if you're killed by execution, you come back in the night, not as the ghost, but as the blob, which is a ghost with no light that walks around, which is the blob. And if the blob grips you, you become part of the blob as well and also can't speak and also roam around
horrible.
In the night.
That's horrible.
It's absolutely I didn't see this, but apparently that game ended with Alan at the Cabin Con itself, stood on top of a toilet cubicle going, get away, get away, while a ghost with 12 people was trying to grab him from below, or a blob from 12 people. Imagine everything I'm telling you, but with like 30 different roles, you know, with, you know, all different kinds of monsters. There's the alpha werewolf where you know, in addition to if you're playing it in a game with large enough player counts, the alpha werewolf can kill people by double tapping. But if they instead grab you by the wrist and say, you're a werewolf now, you become a werewolf and join the werewolf team, but they can only do that once. Which led to just, it's a game of farce. It's like, which led to, like, Alan ran into the room where I was hiding behind a table, killed the person next to me who screamed. I then screamed, oh my God, Alan's the werewolf! Which, if you're in a house which has been silent for 7 minutes, is hilarious. only for Alan to then grab me and use the alpha wolf power and say, you're the werewolf now. So then we went into the next voting session with me being like, yeah, I don't know what happened. Alan was definitely the werewolf, but he got away, I guess. I just ran away and he didn't see me. Unbelievably stupid. I'm so full of stories. Like, I got one of the later games we played, I got the lover, which is similar to regular werewolf. You know, in regular werewolf, the lovers are people where there's one other villager where if they die, you die as well. In Werewolf in the Dark, the lover has the same thing. If the other lover dies, you die as well. But if when a body is found or the lights come on, you're not holding hands, you both die.
Nice.
So immediately then it's two people creeping around a house in pitch darkness holding hands. And about 3 minutes into the first round, my lover just collapsed to the floor. Like, I was holding her hand, and she just slumped down, and I looked up and saw this vague shape that had just tapped her on the shoulder, and I ran down the... I knew I would die at the end of that phase because my lover was dead, but I could at least survive the night. So I sprinted downstairs, hid, and then yelled back up the basement stairs, okay, everybody on the first floor, the murderer's up there with you, and there's a body, and you need to find it because the murderer's probably going to kill you one by one, but I'm not going up there, so good luck. We've played games where you can't talk, right? And we've played games, you know, which take place over a real physical space. But I think Werewolf in the Dark is so juicy for being a game where you can't talk, but you absolutely can at any moment you want to. You know, you can't move, but you can at any moment you want to. It's for a game that's so, like, contrived in some ways, it's just so freeing. And every single game resulted in...
It is interesting as well. Stories. I think that there's something about, like, you know, I could talk for a long time, and I won't right now, about how eyes work and how vision works and how it's mostly just inventing stuff. But effectively...
No, I mean, I think you should talk just a little bit about that, because what surprised me about Werewolf in the Dark is you're not just fumbling around in the dark. You're playing with night vision, and that is completely different.
A little speed run on human eyes. Effectively, human eyes aren't very good. If you've used a camera, then cameras, you have to choose what do you want. Do you want it to be, like, you know, having a really fast kind of shutter speed? Do you want to have, like, a really nice kind of sharp focus? Or do you want to be able to see, like, lots of things? And with a camera, you can't do all those things, right? There's something that doesn't work. But human vision, you think, well, actually, we've got it all, right? It's, like, sharp, it's clear. It's not blurry at any point. Well, that's not true. Human vision is actually tremendously blurry. And what happens is every time we move our eyes, our brain destroys the data of that movement. And it's like a horrendous blur. If we could see it, it would make us feel really ill all the time. So it just basically, it deletes it. So if you're moving your head around, doesn't count. Every time you're moving your eyes left and right, etc., it's literally just teleporting your vision from one place to another. And then retroactively inventing the footage in between, which is why there's all sorts of strange things to do with people being bystanders, people being witnesses, and lots of fuzziness there, because your brain effectively is making up stuff all the time. Like, we've only got color in the middle of our vision. The rest of it, your brain just sort of colors it in. And if that person to your left-hand side is wearing red trousers and your brain thought they were green, hey, guess what? Your brain just retroactively changed your memory so they were always the color they actually are. And things don't snap and change color later, because reality is a fictional videotape that we're constantly editing for ourselves. So if you think of that and you know all that's true, then what do you think happens when, like, it's really dark? Hello, everything goes weird and wrong because you can't just retroactively. Yeah.
It's like a dream sequence. You know, it's not just moving around in the dark. It's your brain trying to make sense of all this information. And then incredibly whack stuff happens. Like, we were playing with famous board game designer Isaac Vega, and no one had seen him for the entire game. And then when a body was found, he stood up from the sofa, which he was lying on for the entire game, and no one had been able to see him just because of the cast of the light. But if you'd asked any of us, we would have said no one was on that sofa.
Exactly. And also, when you have these, the second part of it, and this is me, this is not, like, fact, but it makes sense to me, and I think if there's anyone who knows more about this than me and says I'm wrong, cool, let me know. But in my mind, usually these little snap decisions where your brain goes, no, that was wrong. We're actually going to change that. Now, those trousers are actually red, not green. We're going to change that. These are like brief blinks, right? But when you're in a fight or flight scenario and you're in the dark and there's something moving around, it's not that simple, right? You can't be like, oh, that thing that was moving around 5 seconds, actually, it was always Jeff, right? And it wasn't like a monster. It's because your brain has to make a decision, has to start dealing with the information when you still don't know the facts. And so you do have these things like you were talking about earlier of being like a weird shape moving and then you realize it's a person, right? It doesn't retroactively change that. It still was this weird shape. And yeah. You still have the memory of the weird shape. And that's really scary. But I think it's...
Yeah.
The reason I think it's so exciting is because I think as soon as you are forced into this fight or flight position where your body effectively is like pressing the alarm buttons because its sensory information has gotten so poor that it's like we're at risk. Like we don't have the capacity to actually function properly right now. And so because of that, like everything is more exciting. And I think that that is why like lots of things are exciting. If you can get yourself into a genuine fight or flight situation, but in a scenario where you are actually safe and having a nice time, then God, yeah. And I think it's perfect that this is Werewolf because I've noticed that playing the original Werewolf, that point where everyone closes their eyes, everyone gets giggly and excited because actually, yeah, I think that's what it is. Yeah. I think the brain is like, as soon as you shut off one of your senses, it's that you're putting yourself into that position of trust where your body is generally like, okay, we could be in trouble now. But because that, and because you know you're in a place having fun, everything suddenly just feels more fun and bubbly and exciting and a little bit edgy. And it's perfect putting Werewolf completely in the dark. Why not?
That's exactly it. It's the moment the lights go off. In regular Werewolf, you know, it's like the abstract idea of like, you know, killing and lynching. But in Werewolf in the Dark, the moment the lights go off, you go, oh, right, I'm going to die. I'm going to be killed by a predator. Like, and it's so goofy. And yet, so this is where the game is at its best and at its most dangerous. And I can't imagine the waiver they're going to need to put on the Kickstarter, assuming it reaches crowdfunding. Because the number one rule Alan told us is do not run. I'll tell you who broke that rule. Alan himself all the time.
Yeah.
And we all did because it was so great. So this leads to the best and funniest things in Werewolf in the Dark where you'll be all giggly and nervous. It's a game where I started freaking out because I was laughing and then I couldn't stop laughing. And the laughing was making me a target because you could hear me laughing in the dark. And so I was in this bizarre experience of trying to regulate my breathing to be silent and I couldn't and I kept giggling. It leads to wonderful things where you'll be hiding, in a bedroom for 7 minutes and then you'll hear from downstairs or through three walls, oh my God! And then eight thumps, boom, 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 boom. And then silence and you have no idea what happened. But this is how players injured themselves multiple times during my 7 or 8 games of Werewolf in the Dark. So first off, we had a woman who sprinted down a corridor to get away from a werewolf. Wasn't a corridor. It was the steps to the basement. Bam, 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 bam. She was okay, just. We had a gentleman who gave himself a concussion by running full speed into a light switch. He didn't regret it at all. He had a great time and would absolutely play Werewolf in the Dark again. I loved it. And then there was the time that I was the werewolf in a final round. There were 6 players left to kill. And I knew that there were so many ghosts around with so much light that I just knew I had to do this quickly or not at all. So if anyone has seen Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, there's a really famous shot where Freddy Krueger's running down the street, but with arms that are about 6 feet long on either side. I tried to do that because I didn't know where the villagers were, but I just figured if my arms spanned the entire 6-foot corridor, then I would get them all. So I'm sort of like wobbling like in a creepy crouch walk down, trying to touch everybody. And I got down to the very end of the room and there was a villager on the other side of a table in a large hall. And what I didn't know, but know now, is that she did, I believe, a crap load of CrossFit and was unbelievably competitive. So she was one of the last people I had to kill. And as I ran towards her, she moved around the table at a speed that I could have got her if I'd known how fast I had to move, but I didn't. So she bolted like a rabbit. She sprinted through the room at unbelievable speed straight into a pile of chairs we'd left on the table.
Oh my God.
So we heard a kind of, Quinn's is the werewolf! And she collapsed into just a pile of werewolf that was collapsed into a pile of chairs where the legs were like up, you know? So it's good like Lord. A porcupine.
Oh.
And she thudded straight into the pile of that. Again, wasn't injured enough. That was like her favorite round. She had an absolute blast. But like,
yeah,
my God, that's your big caveat playing this game.
When you sort of told us briefly that somebody had suffered a concussion whilst playing a game in the dark that was too exciting, my immediate reaction was just said, I bet they didn't mind at all. And you were like, nope, not at all. Because yeah. I had a similar thing happen to me. I was doing a thing in London years ago called Zombies Run, which was just like a real life experiential thing, which just meant you were pretending to try and get through a web of zombies in the streets of South London back before loads of people lived in South London. And you could kind of do that in the night and people wouldn't be horrified. But it was incredible. And there was a point where I had to get past some zombies. And I was so into it that I just ran so fast to get past them. And I did. But I was running so fast that then I was trying to change direction whilst running. And I was trying to basically do a Mario Kart drift boost. And it didn't work. I just remember trying to turn. And it was just like, yeah, my body is turning. But I'm still going really fast in the same direction. And so I just completely wiped out and like put my hands forward and ended up like gouging a big bit out of my hand. Because I, like, you know, hit the tarmac, basically, with my hands.
But you got away from the
zombies. Oh, my God, Matt, you're bleeding. Oh, my God. And I was just like, God, they didn't get me. I was just like, they didn't get me. So it's like, yeah. But you're right. It's like, do you have to caveat this? Do you have to have a waiver? No, I mean, really, what you need is a waiver for your house, right? And I mean, this to me feels like something that'd be an amazing game to play in a place where, yes, you go and play it in a place and you sign a waiver. But I imagine you have to, like, do to your house what you do to a house when you've got like a friend with four toddlers arriving, right? Just like no corners.
Yeah, you have to move all the furniture out of the way. Yep. Like the other big thing to flag up is that a lot of us were talking about how this is a great game for American suburban houses where you can achieve total darkness and have lots of space. British houses, almost like it's basically just a no. Like the amount of space you need. However, if this game takes off, I will say that it's so good, it's categorically worth renting a big Airbnb exclusively for the purpose of playing a weekend full of Werewolf in the Dark and then do whatever in the day, go for walks, drink, I don't care.
A just big emphasis on air, right? You're going to need balloons. You're going to need like lots of inflatables.
No, I just prefer the idea that if this game takes off up and down the country, there'll be really big listed building Airbnbs with head-shaped dents in the walls.
Woof bang pow, what a podcast. I want to run around the dark and cause trouble. Hey, Quince, do you remember dancing eggs years ago? Imagine dancing eggs in the dark. That's where people die.
That's just, if you wanted a game to put someone's eye out, dancing eggs in the dark.
What the hell is dancing eggs?
That's another story for another time. Thank you very much for listening to the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast about board games, games, and the people who love board games.
Tom, you just got to go to Board Game Geek and search for Dancing Eggs. It's only Hubba's best game.
If you go to BGG, then like most of the entries in files are obituaries. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the podcast. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.